What, it's quite real. I mean, whatever it's about, quite real. I just don't know for certain if it's what it seems to be. And I keep saying this on the air because people are jumping to the conclusion that a thing like this must be UFOs. But it may not be that. It may be something in a sense more wonderful. I say in the book that I keep returning to the human side of it, because even if it does involve visitors from another planet, the part of it that's important to us is what happens to us and how we feel about it and how we react to it. And that's what the book is about. It's about reacting to the unknown, really. About living with the unknown. Sounds to me like you're telling me you were taken aboard a flying saucer by little men. And I was terribly embarrassed because it's true, that's what it sounded like. After my doctor said this, I went home and I read a book about UFOs because I thought maybe I could find some more information. I found a psychiatrist through a lovely man named Bud Hopkins. Doesn't this sound like real experience? It sounds like there was something there, doesn't it? It's hard to say where this image comes from. Does it come out of our own mind or collective unconscious? Are these real visitors, and do they really look like this? And if they are visitors, then why is this so strange? Why is it so unlike what we would expect it to be? Why come to me? For goodness sakes, I'm a novelist. I wrote horror stories.
To start by reading, and this is from this book, The Trickster and the Paranormal by George P. Hansen, which is a big fat book, and it's a lot of it's very sort of theoretical, abstract theory and stuff. But then there's this chapter on this section on the UFO, and specifically the UFO hoax as he frames it, which is the Bud Hopkins related case, Linda Napolitano, which briefly was the supposed sighting by a couple of intelligence agencies and a high-standing foreign ambassador in the US of this woman, Linda Napolitano, being abducted by aliens, like floating through the wall of a building into a flying saucer and taken away. And there was another witness from far off who saw it, supposedly. And what this Hansen uncovers is that really the case didn't add up at all, and that Hopkins and others involved in the UFO community didn't really do very much investigation. Hopkins didn't even check the weather that night. Very rudimentary stuff he neglected to do. And so Hansen's conclusion is that essentially Hopkins was hoaxed. He doesn't opine as to who was behind the hoax, if it was more than just a few people or not. But he does suggest that essentially in order for the hoax to become, like socially significant, to really have any impact, depended on Hopkins, like Hopkins believing it and then carrying it as it were, you know, propagating it into the media and all the rest of it. So although Hopkins may have been the butt of the hoax, he also became the unwitting facilitator of it, due to possibly his credulous nature. So specific anyway, that's what, as you know, that's what I wanted to talk about. So I'll just read a few bits and then we'll just see what we come up with. Ufology differs from normal science in the subject matter. It lies in the realm of the liminal, the paranormal, and the supernatural. It is an enchanted area where the rules of the rational world do not apply. Those with only a casual acquaintance with UFO phenomena may not realize that descriptions of extraterrestrial aliens are virtually identical to those of fairies, demons, and other mythical figures. However, many leading US ufologists still abhor such ideas. We see them as discrediting their field. Instead, they have conceptualized the phenomena as ET flesh and blood humanoids traveling in nuts and bolts flying saucers, thereby rationalizing them, keeping them in the normal world and apart from the supernatural. Those ufologists are correct in seeing that associations with the supernatural taint their field and make it unattractive to establishment scientists. However, by suppressing the paranormal aspects and removing them from ufology's purview, they misunderstand the nature of the phenomena and become vulnerable to them. Ufology's perennial victimization by hoaxes is but one example. And then he goes into a comparison with role-playing games, which I'll just read a few brief bits about. Two factors identified above help explicate the connection between UFOs and hoaxes. The first is the matter of social roles. The second is the mythical and magical character of UFO phenomena. The same factors are seen in childhood pretending and in fantasy role-playing games. Children often pretend to be someone else, a mother or father, policeman, fireman, shopkeeper, etc. And this is a natural part of human development. We learn who we are and how to behave by mimicking roles of others. We search for role models. Even as adults, we take roles, e.g. parent, employee, sports enthusiast, homeowner, etc. These roles produce different thoughts and behaviors by us, and they significantly shape our lives. Children experiment with more exotic roles. They play make-believe monsters and sometimes become truly frightened. As adults, we don't completely outgrow our fascination with that. We attend horror movies, watch tales of the supernatural on television, and read horror fiction. Fantasy role-playing games are an adult version of childhood play, and they can be profitably compared with ufology and its hoaxes. This is not meant to demean ufology, but to illuminate it. Both ufology and D&D, that's Dungeons and Dragons, allow direct, immediate involvement with powerful otherworld beings and mythological motifs. Both endeavors have been known to engross the participants. Most players are able to successfully detach themselves from involvement, but occasionally the game becomes obsessive and interferes with real-world pursuits. The problems are far more severe with UFO phenomena than with role-playing games. Ufology does not have the same protective mechanisms as these games. It is not clearly separated from the real world. The Napolitano case is essentially an unbounded version of Dungeons and Dragons. The victims interpreted the hoax's handiwork as due to beings with virtually unlimited magical powers. They believed that ETs could pass through walls, make themselves visible, and even control world events. The magical beings included not only the ET aliens, but also the pantheon of agents of an unreachable evil government conspiracy determined to prevent humankind's knowledge of the ETs. Thus, the interactions of Hopkins et al. With the hoaxes conform with those between humans and gods. Humans question and provoke the gods only at the greatest peril. The proper approach is to appease, mollify, and supplicate them. It should be no surprise that the simplest reality tests of the Napolitano story were not made. Hopkins' failure to search for witnesses actually makes sense in this context. And he goes on, almost all leaders of US ufology remain oblivious to the phenomena's nature. But this has nothing to do with their IQ, education, or professional achievements in other areas. Actually, high accomplishment in established fields may make them more vulnerable, as they may assume that the rational methods effective in those areas will yield results in the UFO problem, or on the UFO problem. When they pursue the UFO topic, they enter an unbounded liminal domain, unaware of its dangers. The problem is compounded by the wish to see ufology gain respectability, i.e. rise in status. In order to further that cause, most investigators embrace a rationalized interpretation of the phenomena, nuts and bolts craft, with flesh and blood aliens. As a result, the blindness is exacerbated, and those people become especially susceptible to hoaxes. Okay, and then there's just a little bit more from the website, which is also connected to this book that I sent you the link to. We believe that other motivating factors and concepts provide a better explanation and framework for understanding these seemingly bizarre actions. That's better than just, you know, yellow journalism or deceit. We would suggest that perhaps at some semi-conscious level, these individuals do not really believe their UFO investigations to be fully engaged with the real world. Rather, their behavior and statements seem more consistent with something like fantasy role-playing, perhaps akin to the game Dungeons and Dragons. Both ufology and D&D allow direct, immediate involvement with powerful other-world beings and mythological motifs. I guess this is more or less repeating the same material again here. It's more or less going over the same ground. So yeah, I'll wind up with that. Alright, so what do you think, first off?
The fantasy role-playing idea, all the material, liminality, everything, or something specific?
Well, yeah, there's a lot that's going on, isn't there? So, but specifically, the idea, I guess, to start with, that these ufologists don't essentially believe their own narratives.
Right. Yeah, there seems to be an element of wishful thinking that if everything is as they believe it to be, or as it's claimed to be, then there's something there that they can investigate. I don't know why they can't see the psychological aspect, why they deny that. My guess is that they just are not that, you know, they're more attuned to a nuts and bolts view of everything, you know? They don't. Maybe it's a.
Well, isn't that. Wouldn't it be, in a sense, like we talked about last time, about suspending disbelief. Like when you play a role-playing game, the whole point is that you get into it,
right,
that you get lost. So right, you don't want to look flaws, and you don't want to start psychoanalyzing the characters, because then the action starts.
They have to believe it's real in order to get into it, sort of thing. And any hint of the psychological aspect to them means unreality. Another thing that came into my mind, you know, just off the top of my head, was Truman Capote, nonfiction novel, that he supposedly pioneered that genre, In Cold Blood, where he investigated the Clutter murders, got involved with that, and he became part of the story, sort of thing. It's, you know, Communion.
Right.
Some of these other books can be seen as a nonfiction novel, sort of thing. These people are maybe not literally frustrated fiction writers, but so many frustrated fiction writers go on to. Freud, I believe, started out as a younger man wanting to be a novelist. B.F. Skinner wanted to be a novelist, I think.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't really succeed at it. They become psychologists, and then the story they tell is the story of how the psyche works. Now, that doesn't discount anything that they said, or that they, you know, any theories that they later came up with, but, you know, it kind of shows the master impulse behind it is this, you know, play-acting impulse, more so than this completely objective scientific viewpoint, you know?
There's a lot of thoughts firing off in my brain now, because this is where the name Crucial Fictions comes from, just to a large extent, wasn't it? Seeing this about Streber, that that he went from a fiction writer to a non-fiction writer, but he was telling the same story, and so it was like he wanted to upgrade, he wanted to make his fantasy real, and he did. I mean, he successfully did it. He had a non-fiction bestseller in Communion as compared to fiction bestsellers previously with The Hunger and Wolfram, which is not to suggest, needless to say, that he invented a story and pretended it was fiction. His experience was that his imagination spilled over into reality, and proving to him, so to speak, that those previous excursions into fiction had been his attempts to wrestle with this unconscious experience and to translate it into something that his conscious mind could then apprehend, and he didn't realize at the time that it was a real experience until communion.
Yeah.
But you could also kind of turn that upside down,
right,
in the way that we're touching on, which is that it was crucial to him somehow to turn his fiction into non-fiction, which is like these children who have to create or begin creating a fantasy life. It's crucial. It's not just play. It's survival, like the whole dissociative mechanism that if we're in these untenable circumstances as children, we have to create a fantasy life, imaginary friends, quote-unquote, in order to escape that, and it becomes crucial to us that's real, that it becomes real to us, because if it's not sufficiently real, it's not going to protect us from reality.
Yeah.
So if that's kind of the, what's the word, the imprint, like the initial programming that causes us to role play, then that it could very well carry over into adulthood, where you have these adults who are, in Sheba's case, he was a fiction writer, so he was already exploring the imaginal. I don't know about Hopkins' case, was an artist, so he was also in the imaginal realms, naturally felt more comfortable in that realm. And then some, one way or another, they were introduced to the idea of UFOs and aliens, and that presented the possibility of turning the imaginal into something real and becoming engaged in a role-playing activity that would seem totally real to them.
Yeah, I mean, so much only begins to happen when you pretend as if something were real. Say if you take if you look at your daily experience as if it were a dream, if you really seriously engage in that experiment, then that's when things really can start to become strange. Weird things can happen. You know, it starts off, it's just a little joke, it's a little playtime, it's a pastime, it's just an interesting proposition. Okay, well, what if what's happening right now? What if our conversation isn't really happening? What does this mean? What would this be if this was a dream? How would I interpret everything around me? Or if this was a movie I was watching.
Mm-hmm.
When you watch a film, you watch somebody in a car, and then they go to the grocery store, and then they buy a carton of milk. And, you know, that scene can be described by several different film critics as having several different meanings.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and other people who watch the same movie would say, you're crazy. It's just a movie. The guy, he just went to the store and bought a milk. What do you mean that milk represents his mother?
So you're describing, ironically, you're describing the opposite kind of mental exercise, right, to what maybe Hopkins and Sheba are doing.
Opposite, but in a different direction, but it's the same thing where, you know, say if the dream actually was real. What if what I dreamed was actually real?
Yeah.
I'm reminded of Lewis Proud, right? Was his book Dark Intrusions?
Yeah.
I think was the name of the book.
Yeah.
Where he would see I can't remember what he described, the entities that he would see in his half-waking state out of the corner of his eye. I'd have to go back and read the book. I pulled it out, but I haven't checked it. But that sort of thing. I mean, I read that with an open mind, and I have had similar experiences, but I never really completely accepted these things that I would see were real,
mm-hmm.
were actually physically, tangibly real. But I've never really had many intense experiences like that, but I've had similar enough experiences, as we've already discussed somewhat, of the, you know, hypnagogic, hypnopompic mainly experience of waking up and, but kind of getting stuck in between waking and dreaming and having a dream still continuing as you're waking up.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, if you buy into that and you see something and then you accept that it's real and then you begin building up a theory about what that is, you know, that can become self-fulfilling. It builds up and it increases. And eventually you may actually believe that these are some sort of evil spirit entities coming to somehow feed off of your life force as you sleep or whatever.
Do you think it could extend to actually creating real physical effects?
I don't know, to tell you the truth. my own experiences have been kind of in between like that, where I was never really sure. Was I forcing a connection? Was that really a synchronicity? Did it really have any meaning to it? Did the coincidences that happened, were these things that I created? Was it real? Was it not? I've never really been able to determine that and never felt it was important to completely determine that.
Yeah, well, you're sort of, it's characteristic of you to remain on the fence no matter how, no matter how much you feel yourself being pulled one way or another, right? You don't want to commit to anything.
Right. Right.
Which, as we know, as you've described it anyway, that has its negative consequences, but as in you can't ever actually get down to doing anything. But on the other hand, in this context anyway, it could be seen as quite an asset.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're not willing to get swept away by emotional responses or by a desire to believe.
Right, right. Now, this is kind of maybe not off topic, but it's sort of somewhat, at least peripherally related. The whole, let's take the crop circle phenomena, if we want to, I don't know if it's plural or singular phenomenon, where some people choose to believe that the crop circles are somehow the work of, most probably, some sort of alien intervention. And then others say it's a complete hoax. And that sets up the impression, if you believe that it's a hoax, or at least the idea or suggestion, that if it's a hoax, then the hoaxers are completely wise to it, and they are completely tricking and making fools out of the people who believe that the crop circles come from aliens. However, these hoaxers are somehow compelled to go out and hoax. One of the it's a documentary, I believe, on television that I saw several years ago during, you know, a major spate of crop circle activity back in the 90s, I believe it was, late 90s. There was a, I believe it was in Europe, it might have been in the UK, there was a man who claimed that he was the guy who was doing all the crop circles. Yet, this person was also compelled to go out and create the crop circles. Now, on the one hand, you have this hoaxer, supposedly, and on the other hand, you have the believers. And it's not like two separate sides. It's like they're both collaborating to create this magical event. And the hoaxer is compelled by mysterious reasons to create these crop circles, just as much as the people who are compelled to believe them are compelled to believe them. And that just speaks to the fact that everyone has this need or tendency towards mystery. There's a comment in here I'm trying to think of in this article. It's towards the end of the critique of Bud Hopkins. I want to... This is what made me think of this. Hold on for a second. Shortly after they bring up the D&D connection, they say, "The notions and images of powerful other world figures are part of the human condition." And that all speaks to that aspect that... you know, it's not that Hopkins is an evil hoaxer who just wants to, you know, trick the public into buying his books, and this Napolitano woman is a completely jaded individual. I mean, she's obviously, if she was is inspired or influenced by this novel, she's somehow living in a fantasy, playing a fantasy-based game herself. She's part of it. She is the Lady of the Sand, is the, what was it, Dan, the one of the two people who abducted her and took her to a safe house on the beach, and he tried to get her to, and this reminded me of Blue Velvet, and I think these events supposedly happened after Blue Velvet, where he wanted her to put on, take off her clothes and put on a white nightgown, and she refused to, and instead she put the nightgown on over her clothes, and then after he did that, he got on his knees and started babbling incoherently and calling her the Lady of the Sand or something like that, you know? So, you know, not only is that's her, you know, that's her mythical role, she's the High Priestess, as they refer to in this article, so she attains that power. Hopkins is one of her, you know, attendants there, and, you know, it's just, it again just goes to that creating this fantasy play-acting relationship, this fantasy world. And again, you know, it goes back to the dreams. It's like suddenly if you begin to look at the life around you as a dream, things do attain meaning and do become more mysterious and are not mundane and completely limited to just what they are. Anything can mean something else.
Mm-hmm.
It opens up the imagination.
So in our first conversation with Keith, we were talking about like the cognitive dissonance of being part of the group, of being in between, that in-between state between being part of the group and an individual, separate, discrete entity. Yeah? Mm-hmm. So you could say that's a liminal state.
Oh, yeah.
And it seems like we're talking about this now. We're back from a different angle, that you can look at reality as a dream and you can see your dreams as a reality. But neither is quite satisfactory because reality doesn't quite act like a dream and dreams don't quite act like reality. They don't, and the same with the UFO phenomenon. I think this is why we're talking about it, essentially, why it fascinates people. It isn't really the fascination with other beings and other planets. I think that that's kind of got laid on top of this much deeper, more fundamental, like ancient fascination of the human being, experiencing ourselves, like, as a psyche and as a body, experiencing, you know, being alive, being aware of death, being more dead than alive in a sort of poetic sense, because we're, you know, we're going to be dead forever, and we were unborn forever, so our life is just this tiny moment in the context of being dead, let's say. So, and then also, forever, like we've been experiencing the waking and sleeping and the dreams and that mystery that can never quite be solved. So, maybe this is like what we're seeking for. We're seeking for a way to actually enter into and remain in that liminal state or that liminal condition of being both awake and asleep at the same time.
Yeah.
And that, you know, all of the UFO investigation is an attempt, well, maybe not all of it, but most of it seems, because there's this tendency of always wanting to define the boundary, then the ufology is the attempt to actually, like religion, I guess, to make the imaginal actual and to pin it down, and occult ritual also invoke demons and entities and try and get them to materialize. That's like a literal enactment of that process of trying to make the imaginal actual, and so on. I mean, it seems like maybe there's the opposite tendency as well. If you want to astral project or download your consciousness into software, then you're trying to go the other way, then you're trying to actually make the actual imaginal. But it always seems to be aimed at somehow defining that line and learning how to cross that line rather than actually erasing the line completely.
Right, yeah. Well, you know, the word liminal, of course, is based on the Latin word for threshold. So it's threshold isn't just one way, it goes both ways. Mm-hmm. So what is the threshold? Where is the threshold? How do we find the threshold? How do we cross the threshold? How do we cross back over the threshold? It's all about crossing back and forth across the threshold between one world and the other. And it's not that you're completely in one or completely in the other. You want to turn one world completely into the other world. It's a crossing back and forth.
Yeah, you want to have free passage.
Yeah, and what does that mean for us? Is there a goal state or end state in that where you reach the ultimate liminal state where you're forever in the threshold, or is it always a crossing back and forth? I would say it's probably, don't know about an end state or goal, but I believe that crossing back and forth is the issue because we move through various states of consciousness as we go through our lives, the chief one being waking and sleeping, which also involves dreaming, which can occur while we're awake to a certain degree. We can wake up also within dreams to a certain degree, in lucid dreaming, hypnopompic, hypnagogic state, where we cross back and forth at that point. Now, people who are researchers, scientists, theorists, whatever, who purport that dreams are nothing but the memory, it's the setting of daily experience in the memory is just some sort of memory process going on there. Now, if that's true, then as long as we're alive, we're creating memory, so that memory creating is going on at the same time. We're accumulating and creating these memories as we go about our lives, and memories are not 100% accurate. They're always elaborated, so it's never completely one thing or the other. Occasionally, I will get a strong sense that, say, as I'm driving down the street or at work or in the middle of doing something else, I get a flash of something, an image, and it feels as if there was a dream going on the whole time that I was doing something else, even thinking something else. So I am not completely convinced that we're not always dreaming or that there's something going on all the time.
Is waiting for a message of some sort or another.
The door flew open, and the being came rushing into the room, followed by dozens of other ones in dark blue uniforms. Like I had been programmed, I leaped out of bed, threw off my pajamas as fast as I could, and they swept me off my feet and started taking me out of the room. I began to struggle, and they began placing a thing against the side of my head that anesthetized me. I don't need to be the author that thinks he was taken aboard a UFO by little men, believe me.
Well, I mean, if we go out on a limb here, pun intended, yeah. I don't want to talk about that dream again, the intelligent limb dream, but specific limb in terms of what you're doing about dreams, memories, that was Jung's autobiography, wasn't it? Yep. Memories, dreams, reflections. We could say, if we go out on a limb, that as biological organisms, we're here gathering memories. Mm-hmm. And when we die, those memories don't die with us, they get processed into the great universal system. That's I know a lot of people believe this kind of thing, so I don't want to make it an item of belief or anything, but just as a possible model. But if there's something like that were the case, then memories wouldn't be limited to physical existence. They would be more connected to consciousness. Like memories are memories of what we experience as consciousness. So, like you were saying, how dreams can be a sort of way to re-experience memories or process memories and process experiences. I think we know there's definitely an element of that to dreaming. even if it's not exclusively that. But it could also be seen the other way around as well, that our dreams shape our waking life, because the experiences we have while we're dreaming, even if we don't remember them, they have some impact on our consciousness, sometimes profound, and then we would take that into our waking life. Mm-hmm. So it seems like those two states of experience, that both we're gathering memories when we're asleep just as much as when we're awake, and we've got this apparently very clear dividing line, which is when the body's asleep, when the body's awake, and there's a very distinct difference in consciousness, which makes it difficult to remember our dreams. So, well, one thing I was thinking about what you're doing was the castaneda thing, and as I've written about previously, there are parallels between Streeter and Castaneda. They're both writers. They both encountered these transhuman beings and had these transcendental experiences and were transformed by them, and then wrote them down as sort of non-fiction novels. And they both talk about, though Castaneda much more specifically, they talk about a secret life. And Castaneda writes about the memories of the double, which is the memories of the luminosity. So what Castaneda posits is that we exist not just as a physical body receiving information or receiving stimuli through our senses, but we also exist as a luminosity, like as an energy form, and that energy body is also having experience throughout the day and throughout the night. But the memories of the luminosity, because they're not strictly coming through the senses, the five senses, and because our conscious minds, because of the ego, whatever happened there, our conscious awareness is confined to the body, to the five senses, we don't actually remember those memories, so to speak. We can't, they're there, they're happening, but they're not getting through the reducing valve of the, you know, of the brain, let's say. So we're not able to reflect on those memories, like our physical memories, they happen and we can just look right back 5 seconds ago, 10 hours ago, yesterday, last year. We've got a more or less linear thing, whereas the memories of the luminosity, they don't get, we don't have access to the past. So even though apparently we're experiencing them in the moment, just as much as our physical, we can't actually file them in our conscious memory, so we forget them. The moment they happen, we forget them.
Mm.
And so then what Castaneda described is accessing that memory because of the memories of the other self, and that what he says is if you start to access those memories, because the luminous body is able to absorb experience much more and a much more on a vaster kind of level, it feels like you've lived for thousands of years. Mm-hmm. What Streeter describes is encounters with alien beings, traveling to other worlds, you know, and so on and so forth, like you know, Streeter's story. So that, and the you know, the only contrast I have to that, or the only comparison I have, besides my own experience, which is pretty limited, is with Dave O'Shana, who says he's enlightened, and when I first met him, as you may recall, I said, you're not enlightened, you know, you may be this, you may be that, but I've read Castaneda and I know what enlightened is, and it's that you're not it, because I could just tell that he wasn't sort of existing in this state where he was conscious of the whole universe kind of thing. And since then I've talked to Dave about this a little bit, and it's kind of interesting because he does refer to another life, another memory sometimes, sort of obliquely, but it's a very different, like the impression I got from O'Shana is very different. And I asked him once, when I was walking with him, like, so for you, like, walking with me and talking to me, are you experiencing me, a whole other part of me that I'm not experiencing? And he said that he was. And I said, well, so is it like there's this whole other aspect of reality that's hidden from me, but that you're seeing? And he said, kind of, but that hidden isn't the right word, because hidden suggests that there's something is hiding it. So it's like, but with the Shona, it's very paradoxical, because it's like the opposite of Strieber and Castaner. There isn't this feeling of this huge, fantastic other life that he's living or that he's aware of. I don't really know how to actually describe it. I don't know where I'm going with this, but it's as if that the barrier, like that keeps him confined in the mind, has gone. I'm not really sure. I probably can't really say any more about it, Shana, but I was just using it as a counterexample to Strieber and Castaneda. And I think probably many individuals who have started to access what would be seem to be memories of some other life or some other existence, and who have kind of become, I think, become a little bit unhinged by them. I guess that's the only thing I could say about Shana, is it's as though he does have access to this other life or this other way of perceiving the world, but or the reality, but he's not really interested in it. That's the weird thing. He's like, yeah, it's there, but he's here in this body now. So it's not like he's super psychic or anything. It's like he seems to kind of know what he needs to know when he needs to know it. So he's very present and very authentic, and he can see things about me that I don't know how he could see them, but it's as if he himself, he doesn't have access to that stuff. It just comes through him, and then he goes, oh, and he observes it as it's going through him, but he's not trying to get to it. So it's as if there's somehow that separation is healthy and natural. And that removing the threshold or dissolving the line between doesn't mean that the one comes crashing into the other. It's almost the opposite. Like if you remove the threshold, or if you allow yourself to be in that liminal state, then that's the balance. There's a balance there. Whereas if you're trying to access the memories and the dreams and the secret life and the aliens and the sorcerers and all that stuff and pull it into this life, that's when things get screwy, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that's what these role-playing people, that's what we're doing when we get into this crazy role-playing thing where we're trying to make it real. We're trying to use the imaginal or the other life to somehow make this life more real.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't, as you know. It actually just makes this life kind of become insane, and like a schizoid, paranoid nightmare.
Right, if you only go in the one direction and refuse any suggestion that you can or should go the opposite way.
Say that again?
Yeah, like it doesn't go in only one direction, and it's what happens when you refuse to go back the other way. In the way that Hopkins and Clark and the others who favored the nuts and bolts physical interpretation refuse any suggestion at all that it could be psychological. Well, they're on this one side, and they refuse to go back to the other side and even acknowledge that the other direction is possible, you know. But if you cross back and forth in the true liminal fashion, as you would do in a natural way, because you enter and pass through various states throughout life, and you're not, you know, your allegiance isn't to only one side or the other or one state or the other, then you end up with a more natural way of being, because you allow it to flow in whatever direction it goes to without, you know, seizing upon anything and anyone. You know, it's like, I like this view. I'm going to marry myself to this. I'm not going to leave this one viewpoint. I'm only going to use this one lens on my camera and no others. You know, that can distort your mind by doing that.
Yeah, well, it may be that it's the distortion of the mind that's causing that also.
Causing what?
Maybe, like, very distorted mind. Well, it's kind of what you're describing is getting attached to points of view and identifying with them.
Mm-hmm.
So it may be that with Oshana, like, if we take him at his word, that he got enlightened, which is that he pushed out the implant of the ego and doesn't identify with his mind or the contents of his mind, that allows a person to move between those states or those worlds without getting attached to anything and without trying to pin anything down and use it. Mm-hmm. And that may be like the only way to really freely move between the worlds is if you don't have an ego,
yeah.
whatever we mean by ego. If you don't have that investing, that, you know, that part that is investing and in trying to get something for itself,
mm-hmm.
which actually Strieber writes about this. Ironically, he writes very specifically about the way to move this psychic organ, which I think is synonymous with Castaneda's assemblage point, is. To be able to witness other worlds and other states and visions, what have you, other realities, without fixing on them, without getting fixed on them. Mm-hmm. So to be able to see stuff without having any reaction to it. I'm paraphrasing now, but he says, basically, the master of the key told him that he transcribed that this is the way to develop that potential. Mm-hmm. But ironically, I think that's what Strieber. I mean, his life and his story seems to testify that's not really true. That it is possible to access these other states and still be invested in that experience.
Yeah.
And this is, I mean, like personally, and I think you and I have. Got a lot of notes to compare if we wanted, because you've had these really big dreams and visions, like the one that we put on the first audio of getting to see the crucifixion. That's massive, that's a huge dream by any standard, a huge archetypal dream, and yet I mean you've remained very grounded, you know, maybe even too grounded possibly, but compared to myself, who's had similar sorts of dreams, hanging out with Christ and visions of ancient Egypt and other planets, you name it, I became very, as you know, like when I first met you, I was like this, very invested in that whole story of being this visionary guy who was able to access this other reality and who very much wanted to. Dreams were so important to me. Like when I had that intelligent limbs dream, it was a terrifying dream, as you've read, and it had very unpleasant implications, like the sensation of a needle being stuck in the back of my neck and being manipulated by these dark forces, and I describe it that way. This is horrific, this is sinister, but I mean, I don't know about physically, how I felt physically, but mentally, emotionally, I felt great when I woke up from that dream. I thought, yeah, I finally accessed my hidden life. Now I know it's real, and I'm one of the ones, you know, I'm one of the ones who's been chosen to experience these things. And it made my everyday life suddenly more exotic, more glamorous.
Yeah, after all of my somewhat big and some not quite so big dreams, I would go through a period, didn't last very long, where I would have that same sort of after effect, but, you know, it would fade pretty quick for me. But I would still retain, the memory of those dreams and experiences, and they would still inform me and help me, and I feel that they still do, but, yeah, that glamorous part post-dream of your, you know, the afterglow, you know, that didn't, it was there, but it didn't last very long.
But you didn't do anything with it, did you? I mean, you didn't...
No, I tried to do things with it, and that's probably what always knocked me back down to earth, was that I would try and fail, and I couldn't really put it into words. You know, that post that, like I described it, this afterglow, it would last for a while, and I did create various, you know, test egos for myself, where I had, he's like, I'm the one with the answer, you know? And then I tried to put it into effect, and I realized, no, that's not really the answer. I need more, and 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 more. It was never resolved. Yeah. But, you know, that kind of fits into what you just described, your own experience, and I guess mine fits into that whole play-acting ego building. Mm-hmm. You know, power attaining, you know, out of a younger period when we felt powerless, trying to, you know, establish a public persona, an ego, that had some power to it.
Right.
And play acting within that attempt. And it all fits into there. I mean, each one of your phases, each one of my phases, that was a play acting phase, not too dissimilar from Hopkins and these others, but they, you know, they have their one game that they must play, and it must be exactly the way they say it is. And, you know, when you get anybody, at least in my book, when you get anybody who's that focused on just the one game, just the one vision of everything, and it must be this, and it must be exactly as they say, then that's when, you know, I become suspicious of that person. I guess mainly because I've failed to establish that much certainty.
Yeah, well, and I did fail, but I fell. I did more the Icarus thing than whatever your corresponding myth would be. I don't know, but I mean, I tried, and I failed. I failed more dramatically than you, let's say. But
most of my fears were quite as dramatic.
Well, do you think that, like, the nature of this phenomena, the UFO and the paranormal, and that trickster element specifically, maybe, do you think that it has to do with testing that in individuals, like how power mad they are.
It could figure into it, but I wouldn't know exactly what to make out of that, as possibly there's archetypal forces at work, of course, but, you know, is there an intelligence behind it, sort of that suspicion that we get sometimes, and which is somewhat backed by a desire that there is an intelligence to it, even, you know, whatever it is. Something more than just all in my own mind, you know, which is that's the concern that a Hopkins would have, or would have had when he was alive, would be that, you know, if it's psychological, then it's only psychological, and it limits it to that one view.
Well, yeah, but leaving that out...
You know, I mean, what does that more mean?
What does what mean?
What does that sense of, you know, some sort of guiding force or theme to it or lesson to be learned, what does that indicate? Is that purely archetypal and individuation out of the process of individuation, or is there something, some force, some intelligence at work, you know?
Well, does it matter, though? Because even if you leave aside the possibility or the need to posit some external intelligence doing it, you could still observe, like, the process, the effects, the responses, and ask that question again, that question I asked, do these experiences seem to come down to, or is a central element of them, like, an individual discovering his or her own tendencies to get swept away by egomania?
Mm-hmm. Well, I would say that's a major theme in at least my own personal experiences, and a lot of that and those experiences were what the whole Great American Psychopath came from.
Exactly.
And that's, you know, that was all not too long after, but still post all of these experiences with, you know, these recurring UFO dreams and big vision dream experiences that I had. There was all of that in my continual efforts to somehow use this as a basis to build myself a powerful ego, or at least milk all these experiences for whatever I could to write some book or script or create something that would then, you know, make $1 million and give me, you know, my way in the world, you know, and each time being humiliated, ending up in a state of humiliation, you know. And then after all of that and finally reaching sort of like a rest period from that to where I didn't have so many peaks and valleys. And then it wasn't too long after that that the psychopath ideas started to come to me. So, and that's what it's sort of my own psychopath period would be, that aspect of me running off, chasing a vision and running into a tree, which is both metaphorical and an actual things that happened.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all part of my, you know, there's a whole personal story of certain series of dreams and experiences and what they all led to. I've already discussed part of this with you, but we haven't really covered it all fully. But it does kind of fall in that general theme of what you just described.
So then maybe the trickster figure is there in the Great American Psychopath model with the clown to some extent.
Exactly. Yeah, the heroes, the shadow of the hero is the psychopath, the shadow of the psychopath is the clown. Or trickster.
Yeah, this is, I mean, obviously you and I know, but if anyone listens to this, they won't know that we're talking about psychopath with a capital P, which is very different from the popular use of it now, as in a serial killer or a corporate CEO kind of psychopath, and not actually using it in a negative sense. Strictly, right? It's an somebody who's aspiring to, what would you say, like seize their own reality, to absolutely seize reality, to own reality in some way. It can be totally destructive, but it doesn't have to.
Right, yeah, you can, that's an adequate way to describe it.
So maybe it has to do with, I'm just going to talk without knowing what I'm going to say, otherwise I won't be able to talk at all. I'm in one of those states of mind. An inability to laugh at oneself means that the hero ends up as a psychopath and then as a clown. Because that would be the egomania, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you can't laugh at yourself, you're an egomania, essentially.
Exactly.
And that's the investment. Like if you feel like your survival is at stake because of whatever nightmarish environment you grew up into, were born into, that led you to create these fancy roles for yourself and for others, that was a survival strategy at that time, and so then if you continue that strategy into adulthood, your survival is no longer dependent on it in any obvious way. It probably wasn't even obvious back then either, but it's all got pushed into the unconscious. Now you think that you're writing the great American novel, or being the one, or being the avatar for alien intelligence, or whatever it is that has become your fancy role-playing game. But if it's driven by that basic imprint of being life-threatened, then yeah, you take it deadly seriously.
Yeah, it's carrying the adaptive strategy past the period which it is no longer useful. It's like, well, you needed it for that period, but what else did you have at the end of that period? That's all you had to go back on. So if you continue to hit that same strategy and use that, eventually you realize that it's no longer working. Why is it no longer working? Because that doesn't work anymore. You know, it's like, I don't know. I can't make a comparison, but yeah.
Hmm.
It's outlived its usefulness, yet you still carry on in that fashion. It is ego building. The ego protect. The trauma, the early trauma, was a threat to your survival, i.e. ego. That leads to developing that strategy. And then that becomes your method of building your ego. And then you go too far with that. Then you become an egomaniac.
Yeah, then you, what you built is actually like this robot that you're trapped inside of. It's actually directing you to build endless replicas of itself or build a whole kingdom for it to rule over.
Author that thinks he was taken aboard a UFO by little men, believe me.
Taken it again, taken it again. Well, now we ought to be mad at the government, not mad at the people. Taken it again, taken it again. I mean, what are you gonna do?
America is waiting for a message of some sort or another.
Because one of the first role-playing games that kids play is Doctor, right? Or Mummy and Daddy. They play it being adults. They play it being sexual.
Mm-hmm.
I know I did. So it's got to be one of the most basic role-playing games that kids do, because childhood is the liminal state that we all go through. We're neither one thing, we're neither infants nor adults for all those years. And one of the ways we prepare for it, as you're saying, ego-building, well, a lot of it's unconscious and defensive. Well, it's probably all unconscious because this kid isn't thinking I'm building an ego, but I mean,
right.
A lot of it's just reacting, but then some of it is creative, as in role-playing, where the children imitate adults as a way to learn how to be adult.
Mm-hmm.
Forgot where I was going with this. I was going somewhere with it. I was this sexual thing. That a big part of the kind of power and safety that comes from extending those role-playing games into adulthood is trying to create a scenario in which one is potent.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not really a power trip. I mean, it will become that, but it's really an attempt to grow up. Ironically, paradoxically, like when you're children in that liminal state playing the games is an attempt to grow up. But when you're an adult playing the games, you're revealing the fact that you never did grow up. Because
mm-hmm.
you do it unconsciously. Now, if you do it consciously, like I am playing this game now because I never grew up, which is very hard to do because you're not going to attain any status that way. You're just going to look like a clown.
Yeah.
Unless you're an actor. I'm identifying with this. I don't know if you are, but I kind of feel like... I mean, because I feel like I never grew up, and I've kind of been clowning around as an adult, trying, saying, look, this is me as a grown-up, and then, oh, wait, no, I was just being a kid playing a grown-up again. Sorry. And, you know, having to expose myself, or just feeling exposed by that realization that I was just acting out being a grown up,
mm-hmm.
or the process of growing up,
as most grown ups do, I would say.
Yeah, and I think this is like Whitley's Aliens. Even the way he describes them is as midwives to human beings, not quite the same as nannies, but same ballpark, that they're here to help us grow up as a species. That's his viewpoint. Mm-hmm. Hopkins was very different. Hopkins saw them as these malevolent presence, so they were like the guardian, you know, the negative guardian mm-hmm. figure
yeah.
who prevents growth.
My own personal experiences with the whole UFO thing are the recurring dreams. I don't know if we can really cover that sufficiently now, so I won't go into the details right this second. But the general sense that I got from the experiences, whether they came from outside agencies or was archetypal, was sort of similar to, what did you describe of Whitley Strieber's belief of what their purpose is?
That they were midwives or helping humanity to grow up as a species.
Right, was helping me find, you know, helping me mature, helping me, guiding me towards a maturity.
Mm-hmm.
One of the UFO dreams was the one where the Lee Marvin Clint Eastwood dream, you know, which led me to Lee Marvin, which helped me develop a They're maybe not positive. I mean, you think about his more negative characters, but he was a man of action, and he was capable, and he was in control in certain roles, and helped me develop a male ego that I did not develop through dealing with my father.
Uh-huh.
So it led me in a path, and at a certain stage, I had to let go of the Lee Marvin thing. And it was connected with eventually getting together with Gina, my wife, and further maturing and everything. So it led me to a certain point, and then at that point, the UFO dreams and experiences pretty much dropped off, though I still get a few hints here and there. But it seemed to be taking me to a certain stage where I had to let go of that.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I do feel some sort of midwifery, some sort of guidance towards a maturity, something lesson learning going on there. But you can say the same thing about any archetypal experience. Any deep archetypal dream is teaching you lessons and guiding you towards a wholeness and a maturity and an individuation. And that's the same. It's the same force, whether it's archetypal or actual real aliens or merely archetypal stand-ins.
Right. The guidance of the psyche and the deep unconscious part of ourselves is leading us towards wholeness, which is maturity.
And certain people who, like Hopkins, deny the psychological viewpoint, forcing these things to become concrete, to taking them literally, would be distorting the archetypal content. And if you do that, of course, the shadow comes into effect, and that's where you get the evil aliens from. Whereas Stryver is more open to it. He's also a subject of abduction, whereas Hopkins, he's standing outside of it and viewing it and using it to build his own ego as the, you know, as the power, as the investigator. He's acquiring power that way. And, you know, one of the things the authors of the Critique of Bud Hopkins article mentioned was that he didn't really have any credentials. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he's trying to build that credential. Now he's the leading authority, and he's on the morning news shows, and, you know, he's in the media, and he's interviewed, and now he's a big shot kind of thing.
Yeah, and he was trying to help people as well, so it's not like it's all cut and dry. Like, he was providing unqualified therapy, but without charging. So it's very muddy, isn't it? You can't see it as runaway psychosis or egomania. It's a lot more nuanced than that.
Exactly. Well, everything is, of course, more nuanced than, you know. But there was definitely, I would say, an element of that.
Yeah.
Author that thinks he was taken aboard a UFO by little men. Believe me.
Taking it again. Taking it again. Well, now, we ought to be mad at the government, not mad at the people. Taking it again. Again, taking it again. I mean, what are you going to do?
America is waiting for a message of some sort or another.
Yeah, I forgot what I was going to say, too, at that point. Streamer. Well, it was to do with the liminality. Like, isn't what's most interesting or most compelling and most fruitful to explore about this subject, the wider subject of liminality and of, I guess, bringing it back to the hoaxing thing, this element of hoaxing and how there's a sort of complicity, if not conspiracy, to hoax and to be hoaxed, to the extent that it's like deep in our psyche, the installation of this false reality generator called the ego that's constantly hoaxing us. So the whole universe is getting reinterpreted through that reality generator or illusion generator. So the whole universe is being turned into a hoax. So then even the gods, so to speak, become tricksters. So then it's like, we can't, in the end, all we can really study is our own instruments. But that's the thing that we need to study. Right? What the hell is going on here that we actually don't know the difference between up and down, and day and night, black and white, real and unreal, that we can't tell the difference? I mean, millions of billions of people maybe don't even think about it, wouldn't even say don't think, they think they can, because maybe they don't even think about it. But I can't speak for billions of people, I only speak for you and I, well, for you, I mean, for me. No, I'm going to speak for you. And to some extent, you know, the explorers and investigators in this field, based on what they write, we don't seem to know the difference between what's real and unreal, and that is a compelling question. Like, rather than trying to answer what's real and what's unreal, although that obviously is on a personal level, that's got to be the end goal, you know, finding the bedrock. But in a more general sense, what is it about this, about us, that makes us constantly falling for hoaxes? What is it that prevents us from being able to distinguish between the real and unreal? Like that, and that's what Strieber hasn't focused on, what Hopkins didn't, what, you know, what Castaneda didn't focus on, right? On the opposite, right? Insisting that this is real, is actually a way to steamroll over that much more compelling question that we don't know what real is anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I don't know if we will ever really resolve that, or if that is the point, or even advisable to nail that down 100% and say we're done, this is real, this is unreal. I don't know if this is off the topic of that or not, but I believe one of the reasons we engage in this sort of activity, the whole play acting, whether we seem to do it constantly or we just go through periods where we play act as well, it makes life a little more interesting, you know? Why do we play? Well, we play because it's fun. All animals play. It's just part of our play. So there may be no larger goal or point of it other than just that's what we do, because it's more interesting than just eating and breathing and shitting and pissing and reproducing.
Yes.
And that might be as far as you can go with it. I don't know.
There's a difference, though, isn't there, between playing because it's fun and playing because you believe that it's really real.
Right, and sometimes you have to pretend as if it were real, as if versus believing it was real.
Yeah.
You pretend as if so you can engage in the play. Otherwise, you know, it's like foreplay or imagination's role in sex, you know, yeah, as they say. You know, it's like just the bare act is not enough. You need a little bit of mystique and mystery, a little bit of theater to go along with it.
Yeah. You know,
it's entering a darkened movie theater to see a film versus, you know, watching it on an iPod on a subway, you know. It's like, well, one is a little more conducive to entering a certain state and believing in it and following along, and another one is just conducive to gathering information and not really getting lost in the experience, getting lost and then finding yourself, going into the darkened theater and then coming out into the light.
America is waiting for a message of some sort or another.
Is it an elaborate, is this a novel, basically, is your question. Is this a new kind of novel, a novel that pretends to be nonfiction so completely that the author is even willing to go on a tour and say this is true, but it actually isn't. No. They're indistinguishable from real memory.
No will whatsoever. No will whatsoever. Absolutely. No will whatsoever.
said they were going to do an operation on my brain. They inserted a needle into my head, and there was a needle mark in my head. I did react to this as if I had been traumatized. I went to the doctor. UFOs were a matter of absolute indifference to me. I'm more interested in the number of pages in the New York telephone directory than I am in UFOs. I was before this happened. On the night of December the 26th, 1985, I was waked up by a funny swirling sound coming from the living room. No sooner had I sat up in bed than I saw a small figure, about 3.5 to 4 feet tall, peep around the bedroom door, wearing a flat, very wide-brimmed hat, helmet, rather. And I thought, how interesting, I'm dreaming. I'm awake, but I'm still dreaming. My dreams have not stopped, even though I'm awake.